from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll talk with poet and novelist Chris Katsaropoulos about his latest novel titled Entrevoir.
I'll chat with Sean Baker, music maker, about his new musical adaptation of the movie 10.
And I'll get a preview of this year's Talbot Street Art Fair. Plus, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What do we do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Writer Chris Katsaropoulos writes poetry as well as prose, so it's not surprising that his new novel, Entrevoir, is filled with long stream-of-consciousness poetic passages. Sharon Gamble invited Chris in to learn about his new novel, which he'll be signing at Book Mama's in Irvington on June 20th.
So this novel is a little experimental in its format. Why don't you start? Let's start with the We'll do the Platonic Ladder of Love. We'll start with something concrete. Tell me about the sculpture that the protagonist is trying to create.
Yes, absolutely. So the main character in the book is Jacob, and he's a world-renowned modern conceptual artist, and he makes really good money doing this. He's had a career doing installation pieces in New York and Moscow and Shanghai, all over the world. But this time he has taken his family to a remote village in the south of France, perched on the top of a huge rock, basically, called Entrevoir. It's the name of the village, and it means glimpse, because you could only see this. The reason they built the village on the top of the rock is you could only see it from certain, you could only get glimpses of it from down below. So it was well protected. So he wanted to do an installation piece in a high place at the summit of a rock, because the purpose of this piece is to enable the person who is viewing it to experience what it is like to see the face of God, which is a fairly lofty ambition for any piece of art, and that's what he has undertaken. And the piece itself, if I can describe it, it's described in various points of the book, but it's basically you wind your way up to the top of this remote outcropping of rock where there's a little plateau, and it's kind of like walking a labyrinth. So there's a spiritual experience of taking the journey to get to the piece, which is actually part of bringing the viewer into the piece. The viewer has to actually make a pilgrimage. It's work to get to the top. Mm-hmm. But then once if they've done that much work, they get the opportunity to see this piece, which is these giant curtains, I would say, of gossamer metallic fabric strung up on these metal pylons, but they are allowed to play in the wind and in the sun, in the light of the south of France. So it has this magical aspect to it, and the viewer winds through the piece again, still in the way of a labyrinth. And so the different aspects, viewpoints that the viewer sees are aligned with certain key astronomical events, things such as the sunrise on the summer solstice, the sunset on the winter solstice. All of these things are alignments that the viewer sees in the piece. And so it's an experiential piece of art, and it changes over time, from day to day, from hour to hour, and minute to minute.
From
viewer to viewer. They're bringing their own experience to this piece of art. And so that's how I can best describe it.
How did you get the idea for this character and his quest?
So I guess it relates somewhat to my own artistic endeavor, which is to try and bring different states of conscious awareness to the reader, to the experiencer of the art, and that's what Jacob is trying to do within this book. So it's about the artist's journey himself and what he's trying to accomplish. When an artist sets a very lofty goal, it's a huge risk. It affects his personal life. It affects every facet of his life, and it also is a journey. And so that's the undertaking that I'm trying to describe in the book. And also by doing that, it opens Jacob, the artist, up to this experience that happens in the book that the reader is taken on. The entire novel takes place within the span of a single moment, although it spans everything that takes place within the novel spans millions of years.
Mm-hmm.
It takes place on Earth, on other planets, in other dimensions. And Jacob, basically, his conscious awareness opens up to past lives, future lives, lives in other dimensions, and he experiences it all at once in a flash. It could be likened to what some people have heard about of the past life review, the life review that happens when someone passes away.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that is part of common awareness, spiritual understanding, is that, you know, your entire people, it's kind of a common term, your entire life passes before your eyes. This is, in this instance, Jacob's entire lives pass before his eyes all at once.
It's kind of like what passes before his view is the history of being human.
In a way. I mean, he has had so, and this is my personal belief through some of my own experiences. We've all had so many lives that we've experienced everything that can be experienced as a human being, and even beings in other types of beings too. We have had lives in other types of bodies and other types of dimensions and other places. So yes, this is all part of being human and what it means to be a spiritual human being.
I'm intrigued by the fact that Jacob, so what's happening on the night when this happens is a cocktail party at their house in this remote place in France, and
yes,
he's married to this beautiful woman who has serious doubts about why they're, you know, they've been in these gorgeous cities, the, you know, the meccas for art, and they're in this remote place, and, you know, I don't know how much of it is in his head and how much of it is really coming from her, but serious doubts are happening in this
yes,
beautiful old stone household about what's going on. And he hears the voices of his son and his daughter downstairs greeting their guests while he and his wife are making final preparations. But it's intriguing to me that what launches his journey is the moment of doubt, not his own solid belief in
the
worthiness of this installation.
Yes, there are huge doubts. That's the beginning of the book, is the unveiling. Every, you know, piece of art like this has an unveiling, you know, an installation, and Jacob is used to having throngs of people come to his unveilings. You know, the highest of the art world cognoscenti come to see the next piece from Jacob Marsteller. Well, not in this case. In this case, he has done something risky enough and remote enough that only some of the village neighbors and local friends have bothered to show up. So there has been, as you said, this intermarital strife the whole way through, because his wife, supportive as she is, really didn't want to come to this little outpost, even though it's in the south of France and very beautiful. It's away from everything they know. Basically, the Manhattan, you know, New York art scene is where they have come from. So the unveiling is, no one's coming. He's not used to this. And these doubts and the turmoil between him and his wife are what, when he sees her turn her back to him and turn away from him, it's the instant that triggers him having this, you could call it an epiphany, vision, whatever it is, past life opening up. He's taken basically out of his body to all these other places. And at certain points within the novel, he comes back, you know, it's all about glimpses. The whole book, Entrevoir, means glimpse in French. So it's all these glimpses of all these little things, but they all make a huge, big picture. But he comes back and gets glimpses of Maria, his wife, walking down the stairs. But in that moment, he's totally transformed by everything that he sees.
You have a passage you're going to read to us that might be a good time for that.
Sure. This is, I'm going to read, the book has, it takes place all in one moment. So there are just a little bit about the form and the experimental nature of the book that you mentioned at the beginning. There are no breaks throughout the whole book.
Right.
It's one long passage, 160 some pages long, with no break, no chapters, no pause, because it's all happening in one moment. But this particular moment is when he's in this place. It's another mountaintop, which is a theme throughout the book, where there are stones, and he is with these beings that he's not really sure who they are, but he learns different things through all of these experiences that he encounters. So these are the same ones come to visit him again. For some reason, he thinks of them as the council, though he doubts they call themselves that. Now another one appears far off to the right of his inner vision, golden yellow in color, each of them with their distinctive bandwidth, vibrating frequencies. They appear and disappear, reappearing again in different places within the glowing magenta darkness of his inner vision, his eyes still closed to feel the wind on the top of that steep hill howling past his face. He feels them intertwine with him, approach and emerge, dilate and inflate within his consciousness. As long as cut down when one comes, the others come beneath the tempts and times, already launched and milking, already how long the stars grow, feeling them intertwine with him, coming to the front door of his soul, verified and scuttering, keen with wisdom, lost not found, keen with anything to say that he mayhaps already knew, three spirits gleaming in his vision, windswept on the pinnacle. These have always been here with him, and guardians more than these, hearing his feeling his thoughts, they speak to him. They always have been during his voyage, saying to him, speaking directly to withstand him, saying, as those beings used that box for a moment to appear to you and to that family, you use bodies to have presence in different time-space instants. Reference points, you materialize your thoughts into physical expressions. The bodies you use are merely containers for these statements, these states of your being. And these containers are in turn bundled up and stored within your soul. The bodies rest within the soul, not the other way around. And the soul, in turn, is merely the vessel that carries all of these things, stores them, so to speak, so that you may revisit them when you need to, whenever you want to experience another facet of your being once again. All exist at once. There is no such thing as time. Thought creates time, and time creates fear, as you have seen and felt. Time is merely a sequence of thought, and the feeling of sequence creates the sensation of lack, of fleeting things that one moment are here and the next are gone. You are not the body, and you are not the mind, not the thoughts you think. You are not even the soul. The body is the container of the mind, of the thoughts you identify as you, and the soul is the container of these things, and even the soul is simply the vessel for all these facets of you.
I love how wide-ranging this journey is, and the symbols are from such disparate cultures. What kind of preparation did you do to write this? I have the sense that you're steeped in a number of cultures' vocabularies of spirituality.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yes. A lot of the things that happen in the book are based on my own personal experiences in different states of consciousness, I would say, spiritual awareness. But there are influences from Buddhist, Mayan, Greek, ancient Greek, ancient Hebrew, Persian, so many different places where there are strands that connect all of these spiritual experiences. All of these things are different ways of approaching the top of the mountain that Jacob is on. And that's what, to prepare for this, all I can say is that I guess I've read a lot.
And you've lived.
And I've lived and I've experienced these things.
Yeah.
Many of these things are hard to put into words.
Sure.
But if you know, in that last passage, the prose kind of breaks down into poetry, so mm-hmm. to speak, in many cases, because the lyrical nature of poetry is really the language of something that's experienced within the soul, within the subconscious, within different states of awareness. And straight prose is usually something that's more descriptive of regular states of consciousness. So that is in my writing through all of my books, where these other states of being are described and experienced by the reader. So the only other thing I can say about preparing for this is that I love music, I love art, and I love science. And all of these things are intertwined in all of my books as well.
Sharon Gamble with Chris Katsaropoulos. He'll make an appearance and have a signing of his new novel, Entrevoir, at Book Mamas in Irvington on Saturday, June 20th. You can learn more at bookmamas.com. Again, that's bookmamas.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Sean Baker, the music maker, has appeared all over town as a pianist and vocalist, as a soloist, and with many bands, including the Leisure Kings. But, as they say, now for something completely different. Sean has created a new musical based on the Blake Edwards movie 10. His version, called The Perfect 10, opens this weekend at Theater on the Square. Travis DiNicola spoke with Sean about the show.
Sean, Nathan, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us here.
Absolutely. Sean, let's start with you. I'm a big fan of your work. I've been hearing you play for years. In fact, we've done a show together with Jim Poyser, which has been a lot of fun. But love the work you do with Leisure Kings and your solo work. And now you are creating your first musical. What inspired you to decide to want to create a musical about the movie 10, or based on the movie 10?
Well, I'm a huge fan of writer, director, filmmaker Blake Edwards, early on from his Pink Panther films.
Yeah, of course.
And then one of his main composer, film composer, that he usually always worked with was Henry Mancini.
Mm-hmm.
Fan of his music as well. In fact, did some mentoring by mail with him.
Yeah, I read about that. That you and Mancini corresponded. Did you ever get to meet him?
Or? Oh, yeah, several times.
Cool. Okay.
I was a teenager. I was 17. I would send him my arrangements, and he would write back and give me suggestions or critique. And
mm-hmm.
So naturally, you know, discovering the work of Edwards and Mancini together led me to 10 as a teenager, but I really didn't understand the movie. But as I kept getting older and approaching 40s, I realized, wow, this movie is my story, and it's everyone's story, basically. The idea that you reach middle age and you start to question where your life is going, and sometimes you fantasize about being young and sometimes chase the youngins.
You know, I remember a scene of probably when I was younger than I should have been to see it. But, you know, what I remember, of course, is, you know, Baudelaire coming out of the water with the cornrows and the Ravel's Bolero and Dudley Moore sort of just fumbling around, right? It's such a great piece of music. You know, and I've never been able to hear that music since without thinking of the movie 10.
Right. I think a lot of people feel that way. Well, it's funny because when I ask a lot of people from the time that movie came out that would have gone to see it, that's pretty much all they remember about the movie.
I don't even remember really what the story was, I guess.
But there's a lot of nudity in the movie, and so people remember and Baudelaire, but they don't really remember the story. It's a very poignant, touching story about relationships. Dudley Moore had been in a long-term partnership with Julie Andrews,
mm-hmm.
and they never quite tied the knot, and on his 42nd birthday, he just went nuts and decided he was going to chase after Baudelaire and learn a lesson and finally come back home with his tail between his legs.
So Nathan, you're in this production and you're playing the
I'm playing the role of Tyler.
Tyler.
So he's the perfect 10.
The perfect 10.
So
this is a whole new version. There's no Baudelaire in this. Let's be very clear.
I'm not going to give anything away.
Okay.
There's a little reference to...
A nod.
To people that would know.
Okay.
If not, it doesn't really affect the story, but the 10 in this story really is Nathan.
Okay. So you're the Bo Derek.
I try anyway.
I'm the Dudley Moore.
No,
he's the Bo Derek.
I don't think I would look too good with cornrows.
So now, had you seen the movie before? Or?
I had not. Actually, yeah. I still haven't even seen the movie. Uh-huh. We had a cast get together that I wasn't able to make it to where we watched the movie. But yeah, I still haven't even seen the movie. And from an actually kind of after he was telling me about it, I'm kind of glad I haven't seen the movie.
Yeah.
So I haven't come into the role with any expectations of what it's supposed to be. I can really make it my own.
Okay.
Well, sure. It's kind of easy because you're male and she's female.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's that too.
There's that too. So now it is a musical. So you've written a lot of original pieces for this? Or?
Yeah, I don't really call it a musical so much as a play with music, meaning that the music kind of works subconsciously to the action. It's not like we do a scene and then, we're going to break into a dance number. We're rehearsing in a cabaret bar, so there's a song during a rehearsal, and it's sort of subconscious to what's going on in my character, but it's all in real context rather than like in a musical where suddenly we're just going to sing and dance.
And break on the song. So does Bolero make a cameo at all?
Once again, yes. There's a reference to it that's kind of, well... That's all I want to say.
Okay, fair enough.
See it and find out.
Come and see it and find out. So this has got to be exciting for you, Sean. I mean, and a whole new challenge too. I mean, you've been writing and playing music forever, but this is putting together a show like this is a very different thing.
Yeah, as I was approaching 40, my music composition kind of started drying out, and I guess I needed a new artistic palette upon which to create something. And so I decided, well, let's write a play.
So what's been the biggest challenge for you in doing this?
The biggest challenge initially was just to get it staged, to get the theater to agree to do it.
It's going to be a theater on the square, and Ed Trout's directing.
Yes, and he's doing a fabulous job. I can't be more happy to have him as a director. But other than learning all my lines, I have quite a few of them. The whole process has been really nice and easy and professional. The whole cast is great. We're saving our drama for the stage. Yes. It's very uncommon in theater.
There's always drama in the drama department.
Of course. So Nathan, this is your first show in Indianapolis, right?
Yes.
Is that right? And so for you, what's it been like working on this with Sean? I mean, especially since Sean is both in the show and created the show.
Well, I knew Sean pretty well before I even knew that he wrote a play.
Mm-hmm.
I was working as a bartender, and he approached me and said that he did the show and asked me to come audition. It's been a very interesting experience. It's a lot different than any show that I've ever either done or seen before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been interesting trying to just see how things are going to meld together and how this is going to work. And I think audiences are really going to be very happy with the way that we do certain things in this show. Again, not giving anything away. The way that we do certain things and having it more serious when they're used to seeing something like what we do as comedy.
Okay. Is that what you mean by not really having been in a show like this before? I mean, this sort of, it sounds like a mix of some comedy and drama as well as the music.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's a very interesting mix. I've done a lot of musicals, like straight up musicals before.
Yeah.
And this is the first straight play I've done. Well, for my part anyway, it's a straight play for the longest time since I was in high school. So it's been a fun, interesting challenge. I'm used to a lot longer rehearsal process as well, so it's been fun. It's been challenging, and I like the challenge.
Excellent. So, Sean, is this the first of many, or what do you think?
I don't know yet.
Yeah?
I just the universe spoke to me and said, "Do this," and I did it. But what I'm really hoping audiences will get out of this is, even though the main character is gay, that we're trying to stay away from some of the traditional campy theater stereotypical roles and present this as everyone's story. You know, everyone has a relationship. Everyone has to deal with their family. And the idea that your family may not be your blood, it could be your chosen family or we deal with a lot of different family types. And I'm hoping that that's the message that people get out of this while they're laughing.
While they're laughing. And enjoying themselves.
And
asking where they can buy the soundtrack afterwards.
The soundtrack CD is available on iTunes, or you can buy the physical copy at the box office.
Awesome.
For a perfect $10 bill.
Well, of course. Hey, Sean Baker, Nathan Wills, thank you guys so much for coming into Art of the Matter today.
Thank you for having us.
Travis DiNicola with Sean Baker. Baker created and Ed Trout directs The Perfect Ten, a musical based on the film Ten. It runs from June 5th through July 4th at Theater on the Square. More information at tots.org. That's tots.org. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
The days are growing short.
Until our birthday.
Until our birthdays. The days are growing short, especially until your birthday.
Yes.
Where are you registered?
Around the corner. Oh, on NPR.org,
fly,
I think.
Fly fishing our Oz
actually,
grill out our Oz?
You know what? I got an early birthday gift. Waiters. Fly fishing waiters.
Oh,
I'm pretty excited.
I so hope we can have your picture taken for the WFYI Members Magazine and those waiters.
I'll let you know.
Hey, those of you who are regular listeners know what it's time for. It's time for that calendar we call
What'll We Do? That's right. You got a birthday coming up too,
Not
Sharon.
Till June 28th, though, so people have some time to shop for chocolate.
Okay.
I mean, what?
Right. Hey, lots of fun things coming up at Garfield Park Conservatory. Always good things going on there, including on June 9th, Jungle Tales. This is for kids age 2 to 5. From 10 to 11, and it's their preschool program that focuses on the rainforest and the environment, and you can bring their kids there for some crafts and activities and lots of fun. But they're also doing other cool programs like the Junior Garden Club and programs on reptiles, and they're also starting Music in the Gardens, which is going to be starting on Thursdays, and then they've got a big bonsai show on Saturday and Sunday. Lots of good stuff. Check out Garfield Park and the Conservatory Gardens to get the full schedule.
Speaking of parks and kids, gosh, if you're a regular listener, I don't know how you don't know about this, but just a reminder that PBS Kids in the Park is coming up on June 13th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Military Park, and it's a healthy kids theme this year. It's a family, not only family-friendly, it is a family festival. Bring your kids of all ages. You can meet costume characters affiliated with various PBS programs. Just have a great time with some healthy things to do, healthy things to see.
Yeah.
PBS Kids in the Park, June 13th.
It's always a great day.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, this is kind of cool. It's the return of Ball State University's Musica In Situ. It's a concert series featuring an intergenerational choir, and they sing at different historic sites, and they've done this before, and this year's program all takes place in June, and five different concerts being performed at different places, mainly around Indiana, the ones also in Ohio, and so the idea behind this is that people can hear a variety of choral music, learn a little bit about history and space, and join in some communal singing. It's all directed by Andrew Crow, the director of Ball State's choral activities and the ongoing organizer of this. And so it gets its name from a geological term used to describe a specimen studied in the natural environment it was created. And so that's sort of the idea. Anyway, so what they're doing is this weekend, June 5th at the Lawrence Catholic Church in Muncie, they're performing at 7:30. And then on June 6th at 4 p.m., they're going over to Ohio at the Putnam County Courthouse. And then coming back to Indiana, Muncie on June 7th at 3 p.m. at the Temple Beth El. And then following next weekend, June 12th, North Christian Church in Columbus, Indiana at 7 p.m. And then finally, the Indiana War Memorial here in downtown Indianapolis at 2:30 on June 14th.
Love that. I have that on my radar screen, too. Fascinating buildings to perform in, and the performances will sound
really
different
cool
in each space.
Yeah.
Hey, speaking of interesting spaces, the Harrison Center for the Arts is hosting the Independent Music and Art Festival from noon to 8 on January. You can tell that recent cold weather is affecting me. June 13th.
This
June
is always 13th. Such a great
and,
event.
Oh, what a great day. And it truly is. Noon to 8 p.m. There is so much going on. You can go and stay the whole time. You can go and pop out and go do something else and come back. It's just a day-long festival highlighting local and regional musicians, visual artists, food vendors and crafters and so on and so on and so forth. So
the handicraft exchange is part of that day.
It is indeed.
So,
and there's an outdoor performance of local indie band Dream Chief as well. So that's something to look out for.
That's always a great event. So, again, that's Saturday, June 13th.
Saturday, June 13th, indeed.
Hey, if you need something new for your car, like a new license plate, you might want to consider the new design for the Arts Trust license plate that just came out. If you've already got an Arts Trust license plate and these support funds from this support the Indiana Cultural Trust, then when you get your new one renewed, they're going to change the design just a little bit. It's a little bit more colorful, a little bit funkier. But if you've never had one before and you need to get a new license plate, now would be a great time.
Love it. Very good. You know, if you can't find something to do on June 13th, you haven't listened carefully because I have yet something else going on that weekend.
More.
But wait, there's more. Actually, this starts on June 12th, Friday night, 5 to 11 p.m. Saturday, I believe it goes, well, they didn't tell me the times, but you can find out more on their website, which I'll give you in a second. It's the annual Holy Rosary Italian Street Festival, which is chock full of delicious things to eat and drink, music, and so on and so forth. Their website is IndieItalianFest.org, IndieItalianFest.org, so you can go Friday night or Saturday.
Cool. Hey, Phoenix Theater is performing Green Day's American Idiot, and that is opening this weekend and running through June. But what's really, really cool about it is that you can be a part of the show because they have six seats for each show that are in a balcony that's actually on the stage where you get to be a part of the action. Now, you can't be afraid of heights, and you will have to climb up a ladder or some narrow stairs, and you are there for the show. Once it starts, you're on stage, so you're not going anywhere. But if you want to be a part of that, you can get their balcony seating seats if you go online or call their box office for more information. It's a really cool way to see a great show. It'll be a great production of Phoenix Theaters doing Green Day's American Idiot. Sit on the stage.
I have my tickets. I'm not sitting on the stage.
You're not?
I have my tickets. Oh, no. Okay. Hey, all the month of June, Nickel Plate Arts is encouraging you to patronize all the communities that form their region. That includes Fishers, Noblesville, Cicero, Arcadia, Atlanta, and Tipton. And they have everything from a paint-a-plow festival. Yes, the snowplows are put away for the season, but you know, it will be winter again and they'll come back out. And you have an opportunity to help paint the snowplow blades. So,
wow. Okay.
I know. You know, that's very strange and wonderful.
Yeah.
Also, there's an event at an outdoor pottery studio in Noblesville this very weekend called Mountain of Clay. You can throw some clay in a downtown Noblesville alley pottery studio outside. You'll get on a pottery wheel and create a small bowl or cup incorporated into a larger community public art sculpture. You can find out about these events and music and other kinds of performing and visual arts as part of the month-long June festival at nickelplatearts.org, nickelplatearts.org.
Well, if you've heard me talk about Modus Dance before and thought, I would really like to be a part of that, but maybe didn't want to go take classes down in Fountain Square, their new location on East 10th Street, well, you have no excuse if you live on the north side now, because Modus Dance is moving, at least their classes, some of their classes, to the north side at the JCC. In fact, they're going to be offering modern dance classes through the JCC's adult dance classes through all of June, and maybe more if it's popular. So take some classes from Modus's Sarah Little and find out more information at the JCC Indy under adult dance.
I love it. So the Fishers Chamber Orchestra is performing an all Beethoven program this Sunday. That's June 7th at 3 o'clock at the Promise Church in Fishers. The Emperor Concerto featuring Phoenix Park Kim, as well as the Symphony No. 7. And if you like the Symphony No. 5 and haven't tried Symphony No. 7, here's your chance to hear it live and try it out. That's this Sunday, June 7th, 3 o'clock at the Promise Church in Fishers, Fishers Chamber Orchestra.
That's a lot of numbers of symphonies. I'm going to throw a few more out because with the Lilly Classic Series, Urbanski is conducting Mahler's Symphony No. 5 this weekend. And that's pretty cool. Hilbert Circle Theater on the 6th and then Center Grove High School on the 7th as part of their 317 series where they're going out into the community. And then next weekend, if you need yet another numerical symphony, Beethoven's 9th is being performed by the ISO. And they're going to be at the Hilbert the 11th, 12th, 13th, and then the Palladium on the 14th. 14th, again, Urbanski will be conducting.
You could just go from Beethoven to Beethoven this month.
You could go, what do we get, 9 and 5
and
7?
And
there's a lot of good numbers.
And Emperor Concerto, and yeah.
Yeah.
Love it.
Very cool.
Hey, so
got one more thing, Sharon?
You've heard a lot about high art so far on our calendar today, but I'm going to give you something that might be a little more edgy. Well, American Idiot's pretty edgy. But Comedy Sports, their Friday night show, their late night show is Oz Unscripted. It's an adults-only improvised musical. It's in the 10 o'clock Friday night time slot, so kids shouldn't be up that late anyway. But you can learn more about that at Comedy Sports, Oz Unscripted, Friday nights.
Very cool. And, of course, you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide website. Or listen to Sharon and I next week on that calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Artist Sue Christensen remembers a lot of Talbot Street art fairs. Most of them, in fact, which is quite a feat considering that the 60th annual fair is coming up June 13th and 14th. Sharon Gamble invited Sue to stroll down memory lane and also give us some of her best bets for fairgoers.
All right, so it's radio, so no one has any idea how old you are, so we're not going to tell them, but we're going to tell them you're a veteran of lots of Talbot Street art fairs.
Many moons.
Many moons.
Many moons.
And tell us how you got involved.
Well, I moved to Indianapolis in 1957, and I think the fair started in 56. I don't know if I attended that second fair, but of course I was displaced from Chicago, mm-hmm. and I was an Art Institute student at that time, and coming to Indianapolis, of course, was terrible to me.
Especially in the 50s, because yes. while we have a pretty vibrant art scene, and you're a part of helping to build that here,
right.
the 50s, not so much.
Not so much at
what,
all.
What displaced you? Was it?
My late husband was transferred here.
Oh.
And I can remember getting dressed up and going down to the Circle and putting on my high heels and my hose, and I aligned my seams and my stockings mm-hmm. and my gloves and my hat and went downtown and got off the bus, and there on the Circle was a farmer in bib overalls. That was not the downtown I was used to.
Wow.
And, of course, the art scene was not the art scene that I was used to either. I enrolled at Heron, and I was at that time studying commercial design, and mm-hmm. they had nothing really to offer me.
Still fine art oriented.
Yes, very much so.
Hmm.
And I loved fine art, but I realized early on I was much too practical. I couldn't earn a living there.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to get into the commercial design business. And they couldn't do it for me. I did get a job in town and was a clerk typist for an insurance company. And they had an in-house printer, Harold Moeller. In fact, I think his son does things here with the station. And he taught me how to prepare things for print. I'll always be grateful to him.
Well, that was a lucky stroke.
Yes, it was. It was really great. But I, of course, wanted to be a fine artist. That's what I wanted to do. So,
sure.
of course, I just was drawn to the Talbot Street Art Fair. It was the only game in town at
mm-hmm.
that time.
Mm-hmm.
Although the Art League, which is now the Art Center, was active also, too. And I aligned myself with them also. But I went to the fair and looked it over and thought, oh, I want to be a part of this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I definitely became a part of it.
And you became a large and directive part of it, an organizing force.
Right. I was co-chairman with Joan Kistner it must be about 20 years
mm-hmm.
in there. And we had a fine old time building that fair. It's the oldest, largest free fair in the state. It's wonderful.
And, it predates a number of... If you say art fair to the next 10 people you run into, they might think of Penrod, they might think
right.
of Broad Ripple Art Fair, but Talbot Street predates them and is quite different from them in many ways.
Well, the main thing is it's a free fair.
Right.
And that's the main thing that I can see that I love about it. because anyone can go. You don't have to have a big pocketbook to go to the fair. Anybody's welcome. And the other thing that's very nice about it is that the whole atmosphere is focused on the artist, mm-hmm. not on entertainment or other distractions. It's all geared toward the artists themselves. And most of the artists really appreciate that. When you have to share an audience, especially with Penrod, in one day with all this wonderful other entertainment, of course, it dilutes what you're trying to do.
Sure.
And so Talbot Street is not like that.
What is the average number of artists who participate?
About 270, 250, 270. A lot will depend on if somebody's axle breaks down on the way to the fair.
Well, that is a good point. I mean, your dates have always been kind of in the sweet spot of quote-unquote art fair season.
Right.
For artists who take their show on the road and travel around doing all the spring and summer and early fall mm-hmm. art fairs.
The problem with that is, too, though, that you compete with some other fairs. At the 50th year, I decided not to be co-chairman anymore with Joan, and so I wanted to pursue my own art fair explorations.
Mm-hmm.
And so I left Talbot Street for 2 years. I went to a show in Chicago and one in Columbus, Ohio, thinking that that would be a better situation for me. And let me tell you, I'm back at Talbot Street.
Really? What were really? What were those other experiences like?
Well, the one in Chicago was a show called the Well Street Fair. And when I got up there, first of all, the weather was not that great, which shouldn't say anything about the fair. But I found out it was just a party scene. We were wallpaper.
Oh.
We were wallpaper, and it was the background for people to party.
Huh.
And there was a lot of drinking and a lot of other things being done at the fair that were not conducive to selling artwork.
You were the background cocktail piano, weren't you?
Right. The Columbus Fair was very, very good, but I was not real happy with the caliber of all the work that was there, and so I just didn't go back. I really enjoy Talbot Street. I've done a lot of shows in Chicago. I think I've done every one of Amy Amder's shows there. And Talbot Street rakes high, and it's proven because we're rated in the Sunshine Artist Magazine as the top 100 in the top shows.
Take us behind the scenes about how the artists are selected for Talbot Street.
Well, we have a jury, and people send in their slides or digital images to mm-hmm. us, and we sit on the jury, and we have sheets of paper where we rate them between, I think it's 1 and 5. We also have certain people on the jury that we pick that are indigenous to their media. In other words, we'll have a series of potters, and then they just jury the pottery, and then we'll have a series, in my case, mixed media, and I jury the mixed media. Photography is the same way. And so I think it's a very fair way of jurying.
Tell me about, I know that there's a persistent dialogue, argument, conversation, however you want to phrase it, about the distinction between art and craft. Talk about that to me.
I can give you the lecture I gave my students.
All right.
Okay? What is the difference between commercial art and fine art? It's the same thing as what's the difference between craft and art, okay? If you're a fine artist and you paint things, or if you're a craftsman and you do things and you keep them in your attic and you never expose them to the public, then possibly you can classify yourself as a fine artist. Once you bring your work to the marketplace, then you become a commercial artist. I don't care in which discipline you're in.
Mm-hmm.
If you paint, let's say you paint mountains and you paint seascapes, okay, and you go to an art fair and you sell all your mountains, but you don't sell your seascapes, chances are you're going to go back to your studio and paint more of what you sell.
Yeah.
So therefore, you always become commercial, whether you like to admit it or not, you do get there.
Ah, that's a great distinction. That's a great way to frame it. So are you trying to, in adjudicating the show, are there X number of slots for pottery, X number of slots for jewelry, X number of slots for sculpture, Or is it not quite that scientific? It's more about just having a balance.
We're not that limited. We try to do a balance. Of course, the largest category is jewelry because people buy jewelry. They mm-hmm. love body adornment. Anything you can throw on your body, whether it's purses or scarves or jewelry and things on a stick for your garden, those are all the things that are very popular and sell real well. And so probably we're a little harder on that on those categories when we accept them. But we try to keep a balance because we want to keep the fine quote commercial art in there also.
Mm-hmm. Is there there was early on, because of where Talbot Street Art Fair is and where Heron School of Art used to be, a relationship between the two. Is there still?
Yes, there is. And mainly that's sort of brokered by the Neighborhood Association.
Okay.
Because our Neighborhood Association really works very closely with us. They want the fair there. They like the fair there. They think it enhances their neighborhood. And, of course, Heron is part of their neighborhood. So they're sort of the liaison between Heron and us. We use their facilities. We use their parking facilities for the artists. Mm-hmm. And we've always had a good relationship with them.
How about the neighbors? Because I can just imagine being new to the neighborhood and not knowing when I moved in that there's this force of nature called the Talbot Street Art Fair that's coming our way in June.
I think they feel the same way the people out in Speedway feel about the force of nature that hits them in May.
It's only one weekend.
That's right. And then we're only 2 days, yeah. too, and everybody seems to be very on board with it, yes.
How do you feel about the people who maybe live in the neighborhood and are themselves artists kind of setting up their own shop? Is that okay with you guys?
Sure it is. I mean, what they're living there 24/7,
yeah.
$365 a year. Why are we supposed to go in there and say, okay, now it's all ours? You know, no. And of course, the Harrison Center has opened up shop on that day, too. But that's not unusual. You look at the St. James Court Fair down in Louisville, and every year another street is added onto that fair until it's become really humongously big.
Not as big as the... Have you ever exhibited in the Ann Arbor Art Fairs?
No, I've not tackled that one.
It's like the whole town of Ann Arbor. It's crazy.
Yes. Yeah, it is.
What's your favorite moment of a Talbot Street Art Fair?
Oh, you know, I love the physical part of it all. I love setting up the tent. I like connecting all the connectors and unfurling the tent top and arranging my little house. It's like building my own little gallery. I love that part.
It's like a little ritual.
Yes. And I think that's the most fun, is setting up shop.
Tell us about what we can see when we come to your shop this year.
Well, one thing that I think is really special this year is Joan Kistner, who is, of course, the chairman, and she has been on board for forever, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about her age either. In fact, she and I are contemporaries.
Art keeps you young.
But this was an exciting thing that happened at the last meeting. We're going for a program cover, and she had actually done a painting of the Old Alley Fair.
Really?
And had it. And had, I guess she had either she had sold it and borrowed it back from the person she sold it to. But anyway, she had it and she had done it. And that's going to grace the program this year. And I find that to be very, very exciting for our 60th year. And to have our chairman's painting from year number almost one on the cover, that's really an exciting thing.
Who are some of the most colorful people you've encountered through the years?
Oh, my goodness. Well, of course, Joni Johnson was, of course, the most colorful. And I'm sure a lot of people have still her artwork available. It's too bad she's passed away. Joni was wonderful. She would arrive with an entourage of several people, a card table, a portfolio, a folding chair, and she would set up shop. And one year I was fortunate or unfortunate enough to be set up right next to her. People trampled over me to get to her.
Oh.
It was so funny. But she was so good, and she had this wonderful talent that unfortunately died with her. But I have a piece. Listen, I can't complain that she trampled over me because I bought some of her things myself.
How about somebody who's kind of storied in Indianapolis, Elmer Taflinger?
I remember Elmer very well. When I started doing assemblages, I was doing assemblages using baby bottle nipples that I was casting in plaster in my kitchen.
Huh.
And I had one of them at the Hoosier Salon, and he saw it, and he came to me, and he was giving me all his hearing aid batteries. that he thought I could use in an artwork. And every time I saw him, I guess he must have carried it around in his pocket. He'd reach into his pocket, he'd pick out, he says, "Look what I've got for you." And then he'd bring out his hearing aid batteries. I don't know that I use them. I probably still have them in a box somewhere because I don't throw away anything.
Sharon Gamble with artist Sue Christensen. You can meet Sue and scores of other artists at the 60th Annual Talbot Street Art Fair on Saturday, June 13th and Sunday, June 14th. The fair is anchored by the corner of 16th and Pennsylvania Streets, and it goes north from there. You can find out more at talbotstreet.org. That's T-A-L-B-O-T, street, S-T-R-E-E-T, .org, talbotstreet.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll get a preview of this year's Early Music Festival.
I'll learn all about Gregory Hancock Dance Theater's next production about Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo.
Very cool. And I'll see if I can find out what the cabaret has planned for the rest of the year. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call.
What do we do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.